Welcome to the Lob Podcast, brought to you by Manscaped. Get 20% off Manscaped products when you use code TFT20.
Welcome to the Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield and I'm delighted to say it's another one of those occasions where we've managed to snag ourselves, we're not sure how, but we've managed to snag ourselves another special guest following in the steps of Neville Southall, Gary Mabbutt, Jamie Carragher. We've got another one for you today, and it's, as the conversation progresses, hopefully you'll find it's an incredibly interesting story that has a lot of facets to it. But before I introduce the special guest, let me just introduce the two sort of co-pilots for this discussion. First of all, on what is a very early morning, Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, welcome.
Morning, Stu. Actually, we're an hour ahead of you over here in Spain, so it shouldn't be that early, but relatively to the time I normally get out of bed in the morning, it is pretty early. I've had my cup of coffee and I've had my Spanish croissant, so I'm pretty ready to roll, and it's going to be a fascinating discussion today with a guy who's had an amazing career.
Yeah, so it's not the normal 8 o'clock glass of wine, glass of beer and a chat, is it?
No, I should emphasise, when you say normal 8 o'clock glass of wine, glass of beer, you're talking about in the evening.
Oh, yeah, obviously, yeah.
Not in the morning.
PM, sorry, 2000 hours, yeah.
Yeah, 8 o'clock in the morning is just strictly for vodka.
Brilliant. And our other co-pilot has been on a guest numerous times to talk about the book that he's written. He's a writer with These Football Times. And to be fair, this whole interview, this whole hour has come about really by this guy's sort of dedication and disappearing down a few rabbit holes, which I'm sure he'll explain how we've managed to come up with this episode. Mr. Stephen Bell. Stephen, welcome.
Morning, Stu. Yeah, thanks for that. Yeah, as a Manchester United fan of particularly this gentleman's era, very excited to talk to him about this. I mean, it probably have walked into some Man United recent modern times, but he hit on a squad that was somewhat legendary and will forever be legendary. So yeah, looking forward to talking to him about all that.
Excellent. And so to our special guest, we'll try and keep our chat to a minimum, because clearly this is going to be the guy that you're going to want to hear from. It's a guy, as Stephen's mentioned there, who was at Manchester United under Alex Ferguson. He was there with that crop from the class of 92, incredibly successful professional career. Was brave enough to go abroad to Antwerp, ply his trade across there, came back, played for numerous EFL clubs in a long professional football career. Also known for arguably for the bravery and for speaking out about mental health issues that can affect professionals in the game, which is probably something that's not openly discussed, although we like to think it's the more open times and more accommodating times. But certainly this guy was brave enough to talk about the impact that it had on him during career, post-career, and is now coaching at his beloved Cambridge United and giving back to the youngsters there at their academy. It's a big, warm and very early morning welcome to Mr. Luke Chadwick. Luke, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. That's quite an intro. One of the best I've ever had, so I'm happy with that.
You're welcome. Like I say, when you get the special guests on, I've found that if you give a really good interview, they're more inclined to chat more and just stay that little bit longer. So I try and do my best with the intros. Like I say, Luke, I'm sure, certainly Stephen definitely will have, you know, as a Man United fan, will have questions. Gary definitely will. You know, it's been an incredibly successful career. It's been a long career. It's been an incredibly varied career. And then obviously there's also, like we talked about earlier, there's this sort of, this whole area to do with mental health, sort of post, you know, when you finish playing the game, you know, during the game, what happened via social media, that sort of thing. So I think it's going to be, like I say, absolutely fascinating hour. I think what we'll do is, Stephen, is you're the one who sort of spent spent the time getting this together. If you want to open out with the first question, you know, we've already chatted with Luke. He's happy to go anywhere we want to go with this discussion. So as the Man United fan in the room, if you want to open up with the first question for Luke, you go right ahead, my friend.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. Yeah, just as a bit of background, then I discovered that Luke had spent this time at Antwerp during his formative years with United. And then as I sort of did a bit of digging around with the dates and the timings of it all, I realised that United ended up having this sort of long-term relationship with Antwerp, 15 years of sending out the loanees there for experience. Very successful. You like Sir John O'Shea, Johnny Evans, others went there and went on to have success at United. But I dare say that the deal was struck given the fact that Antwerp, big club in Belgium, perennially near the top of the division, perennially playing in Europe, it was probably pitched as a really good level for them to go out to. But what I discovered in 1998, the first year of the deal, Antwerp, shockingly, rare for them, got relegated into the second tier. In 99, they struggled in that division, stayed mid-table. Meanwhile, United went on to conquer Europe, treble winners, the best team of my generation that I've seen. So suddenly this chasm's opened up between, I guess, in playing and training coming through at United to their sort of number one farming area that they're going to send the trainees out to. But that didn't put Luke off. He went there. So I'm really interested to know about how he found that difference in standard and ultimately his contribution in getting Antwerp back where they belong. So, yeah, I'm keen to know about all that, Luke.
Yeah, so a lot of the move to Antwerp came about when I was 18 years old. So I'd done my scholarship 2 years YTS at Man United, had a really good 2 years and sort of excelled in that, and then signed as a professional and came back in that year that I went to Antwerp at the start of the season, probably seen as someone who could be fighting in and around the first team. But as a young man, after a successful two-year scholarship, I probably let it go to my head a little bit. And that summer, spent a little bit too much time enjoying myself with my friends, going on holiday to Ibiza, I think it was, and probably came back to United not in the best shape possible and struggled that season, didn't do particularly well in the first part of that season. And leading up to Christmas, the club told me that they wanted me to go out and get some experience and go to Antwerp. So I went to watch a game in Belgium just before Christmas, and Antwerp were playing a cup game, and I was just there to watch. And it blew, the atmosphere was absolutely electric, the fireworks going off in the crowd, all the smoke bombs, like a typical European atmosphere. And I thought I couldn't wait to get out there, because my life at Man United was playing in at Gig Lane for the reserves and nowhere near the first team. So this was my first real opportunity to go and play first team football at a senior level, and I jumped at the chance. Two of my friends from the youth team were already out there, so I sort of knew them, so I was comfortable going out there. And the first game I played, I come off the bench and scored, and after scoring that goal, was the first time in my career that the fans sang my name, and the feeling that gave me was absolutely incredible. And I just fell in love with it, and I absolutely loved my time at Antwerp. I think that first season when I was there, the second half of that season, we won the league at a canter, really. We were 16-7 points clear to go back up to the Belgian Premier League, and it was a wonderful experience and something that I'll treasure that forever, being the first club that I played regularly for. I think in terms of the standard was very good but very different. It was a real technical game, a lot more possession based than the Pontins reserve team was at the time that I was playing in at Man United. So it was a completely different game. I think I was very different in the way that I played, because the way that I played football as a young man, every time I get the ball, I'd just run as fast as I can towards the goal and try and dribble with it and make something happen. There weren't many players like that in Belgium at that time, and it sort of made me stand out. And because I was having great success doing it, I forged a good reputation in the Belgian second division at the time, and then the next season when we went up, and then playing in the Belgian Premier League for a small period of time.
I mean, obviously, like I say, it sounds brilliant. And I suppose It's funny because obviously we've done quite a few podcasts, and you know Gary will testify to the best podcasts are the ones where you can hear the passion in someone's voice. And listening to you there talking about your time in Belgium, I guess you know we look at the moment you've got Jadon Sancho across at Dortmund. You know, you talk about it being a different type of football, but I guess not only is the football different, but I guess the culture is different as well. And as a young man, you know, you talk then about sitting in the crowd and couldn't wait to get there. Did you fully immerse yourself in the whole sort of Belgian culture, or was it purely the football and everything else sort of stayed as you were, or did you fully just buy into the whole process?
I wouldn't say I sort of went into the whole. Obviously, I was out there for football, but probably just as important as the football was the life experience that it gave me going to live in a different country. It was a case of starting to feel like a grown-up. Obviously, my whole life had been at United. I lived in digs. Everything was more or less done for me. I didn't have to do much myself, but going out to Belgium was, I was living in a hotel with two other lads, and obviously at times things can descend into stuff you shouldn't be doing in terms of going out. Antwerp's a lively city, and you have to learn fast of how to live your life by yourself, because you didn't really have that same guidance and sort of just told what you had to do at Manchester, because we were away from that sort of bubble of Manchester United then. So it was a really good learning curve in terms of, it was completely different in terms of training. We trained all day a lot of the time. It was different things that you'd do, and it was completely immersed myself in that because I felt part of that team. I felt like a Royal Antwerp player. I didn't feel like just a lad that was on loan from Man United. I felt like an Antwerp player, and I wanted to be like them and do everything that they'd done. So it was an incredible time to grow up and learn. Like at Manchester, I was at that time a real quiet, shy lad, really timid, didn't really speak to other people, really didn't. I was always uncomfortable around the big stars at Man United when like coming through, like cleaning their boots, that sort of thing. I was always scared that I wouldn't do it right. And going out to Antwerp and feeling like being an important player and one of the better players in the team, it gave me a huge amount of self-confidence for when I did go back to Man United and was lucky enough to play a few games in the first team. It helped me a lot in that respect as well.
Gary, you know, we've chatted about this before and the benefits of playing, you know, certainly of English players or British players playing in foreign leagues. And I suppose my difficult question to you, Gary, here you go, you can have this for the first one. You know, we look historically at players like, you know, maybe Ian Rush, who struggles abroad, and yet it seems at the moment the younger a player goes, the more adaptable they are and the more they thrive in that environment. And do you think part of that is to do with hunger and, like Luke said there, you know, almost an acceptance, that almost instant first team recognition? And I suppose ultimately you would like to think that all footballers, that's the ultimate desire, is just to be a part of the first team. And so therefore they sort of buy into this opportunity to go and learn the craft and develop abroad.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think perhaps what may have made things a little easier was the tie between Manchester United and Royal Antwerp anyway. And Luke mentioned that a couple of his buddies were over there already, which, you know, when you talk about Ian Rush and when he went over to Juve, and similar thing with Michael Owen, it felt totally isolated. Whereas obviously Luke had that sort of, some of his chums were already over there. It's interesting, Stu, you know, we've worked on pods two of them together, mate, because I was going to ask Luke about the culture as well, but you sort of usurped me on that one. But one of the things I wanted to ask, and it just sort of firmed my interest up by the way he was saying about the difference in the football. So a couple of things is, A, do you think playing in Belgium in a different type of football made you a better player, a more complete player, because there was a different type of, you got used to play a different environment? And secondly, this is always sort of interested me about when players go on loans to other clubs, and then obviously you have transfers afterwards. Is there a different feeling when you're just a loan player rather than a full transfer? Now, I know you said you felt like an Antwerp player, which might almost answer the question, but I'm interested in, you know, how you sort of felt. Was there a difference that, you know, where you know you're always going back to United, as opposed to, you know, a full transfer when you know, okay, this is a move that's compartmentalised that part of my life and moved on to the other one. So I could, two questions in one there, Luke.
Yeah, I think to answer the second part of the question, like, I went on loan a fair few times throughout my career, and I never really saw myself as a loan player. I always sort of saw myself as that club that I've gone to's player. I think obviously the Antwerp one, I probably knew at some stage I'd go back to Manchester United. I wouldn't stay at Antwerp permanently. But I think the other loans that I had in my career, it was always sort of to go there, and there could be every chance that I'd stay there long term. So I always sort of went to them clubs with the mindset that I was playing for that club. I was their player, albeit being on loan, but I was part of the dressing room there, and I'd act and accordingly. I wouldn't act as if I was on loan from Man United. I'd just be there as exactly the same as everyone else and sort of do as everyone else done, really. I think to answer your first question, I don't think it did change my game at all. And I think that was probably a benefit at the time, because I played one way and that was the way that I played. I think long term that was probably a hindrance maybe in my football career, in terms of I played for Man United because I was at an outstanding quality of being able to run fast with a ball, commit players, beat players and make things happen. I think I didn't have enough after that in terms of the peers that I played with, the likes of David Beckham, Ryan Giggs, where if Beckham weren't getting joy out wide, he could drop deep, get the ball off the centre half and ping an 80-yard pass to send someone through, or Giggsy, who could play just as effectively inside the pitch and do things that way, where I was sort of always staying in a wide position, receive the ball and run with it. I think in my second season at United, I suffered a little bit with problems with my hips and pelvis, which resulted in surgery. And when I came back from that, I'd probably lost a tiny bit of that incredible speed that I had. And without that, I wasn't good enough with everything else to play at that level, to play at a Man United. So in terms of my time at Antwerp, I didn't ever try and change my game and do different things, because I was getting success in the way that I was playing, and that was what made me stand out, and that was what I played for. That's what I loved doing. I just loved running with the ball, and that's what I did all the time, but probably didn't take enough time to learn my game and sort of have other ways of being effective other than just being that lad, the skinny lad on the wing who can run with the ball and make something happen sometimes.
That's fascinating. That's absolutely fascinating. And I mean, it's to your great credit, Luke, and you mentioned earlier about when you were sort of early days at United, and when you came back after signing professional and you sort of weren't in the best condition, you know, thoroughly honest assessment. You know, a lot of players would say, well, you know, the coach didn't like me for some reason, and you know, whatever, and he didn't like the shirt I was wearing. But you know, it's great, you know, to hear somebody be so honest about things, mate.
I mean, Stephen, obviously you're, you know, a passionate Man United fan, and you know, obviously, you know, listening to Luke chat there about, you know, how it made him feel, how it sort of arguably reinvigorated his love for the game, you know, regenerated that hunger and that appetite. You know, you look at the Man United squad now, you know, some of the youth players, and you'll know who's coming through far, far better than I do. But do you sort of wish that there was still this sort of link, you know, where United could have this regular sort of relationship where youth players go and gain that experience abroad?
Yeah. I think the problem is now is that everything's tried to be dealt with in-house. It's become so domesticated, I think, that the clubs are almost scared. Chelsea had that policy where they were just sending everybody out on loan, and now it seems to have gone sort of almost completely back the other way, where youngsters are expected to come through the ranks, and there's so many fail now doing what Luke did and then coming back and starring in that following season, contributing so much in that following season as the understudy to David Beckham, as I remember it. But not just the understudy, the real alternative, as Luke says, he had a completely different style of play where Bex wouldn't necessarily try to beat his fullback. He'd want it in that advanced position already so he could whip a cross in, or he'd play a deep ball, a ball into the box from deep. Luke was that alternative that stretched defences, got down the whitewash, and really put his fullback under pressure. Now, as you say, with the loan system's changed so much, I don't think the teams have these farming out policies now. I think it's to do with the money that's involved in the young talent. I think people are scared, clubs are scared of losing that young talent and the money that they've invested in them. Whereas I think it were a different time, a different era, and Man United certainly just wanted that young, them young players that had the class of 92, though, moving the youth system on even more. And they just wanted that to have that experience, that life experience, that football experience. And I think Luke and the other players I mentioned, John O'Shea, Johnny Evans, are really standout names to show that, that really worked. And yeah, I'd love to see us go back to that.
I mean, obviously, you know, Luke, obviously we've got to talk about being inside Old Trafford. You know, these are the things that certainly as a boy who didn't even come close to the professional game, and these are the sort of conversations and discussions that I live for. I mean, and we've got you for an hour, and I'm sure we could talk about this for days. But in terms of being inside Old Trafford, so you know, as a kid, you know, walking through that door, it's Alex Ferguson. You know, I've seen stuff that you've talked about before, and other players have talked about it as well, and that personal touch that Alex Ferguson had with everybody at the club, you know, from the youngsters' parents, the tea lady, the kit man, you know, he made everything incredible, such a big empire, everything was so personal. But, you know, to get the opportunity to ask a player who has been in there and experienced it and lived it, you know, what is it? What is it like? What was it like, you know, sort of as a youngster, just growing up with, as you said, those iconic names, cleaning their boots, the manager, the class of 92, you know, the lot, just what was it like?
Yeah, obviously it was an incredible, surreal experience, really. I signed for Man United as a schoolboy at 14, and I live in a little village in the south of Cambridge, so it was a bit of a strange move. Not a lot happens where I come from, so for a little kid to sign for Man United was obviously quite a big thing. And I used to go up to Manchester on the weekend, stay up all weekend during, and then every school holiday go up to Manchester until I left school at 16, and I moved up there permanently. I mean, I loved it, but there was loads of trepidation in moving up to Manchester United. I never had any doubt growing up as a kid that I'd be a professional footballer, not in a arrogant or egotistical way. I just always assumed, because I was quite good, that's what I'd end up doing. When I moved up to Manchester, I probably didn't imagine myself playing for Man United because of the standard of player that was there. But I was sort of in two minds. I was quite a homeboy as well. I got homesick when I went away, so I didn't know whether to go or not. My parents told me that, like, this sort of opportunity don't come, and I ended up going up there, signing my scholarship. I was on the phone to my mum every night for the first 2-3 weeks in tears, saying, I want to come home. I just sign for Cambridge and play back home. But after that original time first up there of the homesickness, I just loved it. Them 2 years as a YTS player are unbelievable. But like I said, I was so quiet and shy and sort of so much in awe of these first team players that, whereas most of my peers in the youth team used to be buzzing if they got the opportunity to train with a first team, I wouldn't want to train with a first team. I was happier training with a youth team because I was so scared to go in with these big stars. When the coach was going around looking for someone to train, I'd jump in a toilet and hide to make sure that I could just train with my youth team where I was comfortable. So it was certainly that loan move in Antwerp brought me out myself, and when I went back, like, full of confidence to go in with a first team. But like, it was that season when I was in and around the first team, it was so surreal. It was like I'd get out of bed every morning and sort of think I was in some sort of dream. I couldn't even drive at the time. My missus and girlfriend had taken me to training. I'd be in a dressing room with David Beckham and Ryan Giggs, school skulls, and then go out and train with them. And it was just, what's happening here? This is absolute madness. But like, every day was so intense because the standards were so high, because even training was just as hard as the games in terms of how competitive it was, and just sort of fighting and striving to stay on the level of these players. It was, like I say, the most incredible experience, but at the same time, quite surreal as well, of just me being in that position and training and being with these players. It was amazing, amazing time.
Gary, there's so many things there, isn't there? I mean, one of them is that, to me, what struck me there is that self-confidence of, and maybe this is why I never made it, I'm going to put it down to that, is that absolute belief that you were going to be a professional footballer. I didn't quite have that. And now, thinking about it, that's the only thing that stopped me. But, yeah, you know, Gary, it's, you know, like, you know, he was always destined to play professional football. You know, Lucas was always destined to play professional football for a club. And I guess, you know, Manchester United certainly at the time, probably the greatest club in Europe, arguably, and, you know, as we saw in 99, you know, the greatest club in Europe at the time. But it, to me, obviously, it's what sets professional athletes apart is that absolute genuine belief that somebody feels like they are going to be a professional player, whether it's at Manchester United or whether it's at another club, to me is just something that, I guess, like I say, I can't relate to, which I've now put down to why I never made it. What do you think, Gary?
Well, definitely that's the only thing that it held you back to.
I think you're right. I mean, yeah.
All the other assets were there in plenty of quantity as well. We've had the great sort of privilege to speak to a number of ex-pros, pros and ex-pros on pods, and it's always a bit surprising that when you talk to a footballer, you say, you know, did you always want to be? I mean, we're all frustrated footballers, you know. Outside of the game, we just have the compensation of talking about it and writing about it and such like. But, you know, you speak to some footballers and you say, well, do you always want to be, I always wanted to be, you know, a traffic warden or whatever. It was fascinating. Hernan Crespo, the Argentine striker, always wanted to be a dustbin man, which was always stuck in my mind rather than a professional footballer. But, you know, obviously Luke's the exception to that, and, you know, he could see it come for a long time. I just wanted to perhaps ask Luke, you know, signing for Manchester United as a youngster must have been, you know, stratospherically attractive. But I guess, you know, when you go into a club like Manchester, with the best club in Europe at the time, just won the European Cup, obviously the chances there to break into the first team are more limited because they're drawing more and more talent because of the attractiveness of the club. Were you ever tempted to sign, were there options to sign for another club? I wouldn't say a less celebrated club, but, you know, well, perhaps, yes, I do mean a less celebrated club, where, you know, somebody, you know, of your talents would have perhaps got established in the first team a lot quicker and I'm not saying you had a bad career, far from it, but, you know, your career could have taken a different path. Did you ever sort of have those sort of options? Was there any choice, really? Was it the sole winner?
There was other options to sign as a young player, but once I went to Man United, like, I fell in love with it. I played for Arsenal as an under-13 player in their centre of excellence before I went to United, and I'd train once a week at the indoor bit at Highbury and then play on a Sunday, and someone would have to take me, or I'd get the train, and it always felt like a bit of a pain in the arse. Don't get me wrong, Arsenal was a fantastic football club, but I didn't really like it. I was happier playing with my mates and sort of playing with a smile on my face. It was just a bind more than a pleasure. The second I went up to United, I fell in love with it. The way everyone was, the way you were made to feel, how happy everyone was to be there, how enthusiastic, the whole environment of the culture of the place. I fell in love with it within a week of being there as a trial player. And then, obviously, the manager knowing who you are, Sir Alex Ferguson knows you, this little kid from Cambridge, like that sort of thing. And that's why they were so successful, and that's why they had the pick of any of the young players, really, because the environment was so special. So once I'd experienced that at 14 years old, I'd never have gone to anyone else because I just fell in love with the place.
Fair call, mate. Fair call. Totally understandable, yeah.
Stephen, like I say, and I keep coming back because obviously, you know, you're the Manchester United fan, but I guess for you, you know, it must be, obviously Man United are in transition, shall we say, at the moment. But, you know, it must be great as a Man United fan to hear, you know, to hear players talk so passionately about the club. You know, so much stuff is written in the press. You know, you take the bits that you want from it. But, you know, you listen to Luke speak and it's, you know, and I imagine that this is kind of how it was. You know, you sat with Becks and Paul Scholes and Ryan Giggs, Roy Keane. You know, they're all there. They're all there in the changing room. The manager knows your name, you know, even as a youngster. And I guess as a fan, and Luke mentioned that they were so successful, but I guess as a fan, you must, you know, do you hark back to those days? Do you feel like the club is getting back there under Solskjaer? You know, do you feel that he's bringing back those sort of almost traditions, you like? Or was it just, you know, you're never going to replace Alex Ferguson. You're never going to replace Roy, that crop of Class 92 with Roy Keane as your captain. You're never going to replace all that. But do you feel like under Solskjaer, they're starting to bring back that environment that brought so much success?
I do. I've spoke about this on a previous podcast with yourselves. That era, to me, they were almost godlike, that team. I actually blame them for spoiling my love of football long term, because you just couldn't recreate that era. So much so that I had to start throwing more passion into supporting England, because I was so desperate to see some success that I hadn't seen.
And that was your best shout.
Well, yeah, because I was spoiled. If Manchester United weren't winning everything, then I'd already seen it. Whereas England, I was desperate to see him win something. Whereas now, I've got that hunger back for Manchester United because it's been so long. You used the word transition, Stu, but God, milk.
I was trying to be polite, really.
Yeah, milk transitions quicker than this, doesn't it? But we're getting there now, and I think the other thing is, after some eras, and I would say Van Gaal and Mourinho especially, really, really sucked the life and soul out of the club a little bit in terms of the traditions and the styles of play. I do think that's definitely coming back now. I think the other thing that's coming back is so much pride in the individuals that are there. You know, you look at Marcus Rashford, what he's doing now. I think the way that Ole handles himself when he's getting almost bullied by the press, I think, in terms of him just assuming that he's a temporary stopgap, he's not up to the job. And yet, there they are, they find themselves flying high now and doing really well. He still doesn't quite get the credit that he deserves, I don't think, for that. There's definitely some pride come back to the club, and a style of play, swashbuckling style of play, is coming back a little bit. I think we... Rashford and Martial and Pogba when he fancies it. But yeah, I mean, there's one name that Luke hasn't mentioned yet from that changing room. You just mentioned him, Stu. Luke's mentioned David Beckham and Ryan Giggs and Paul Scholes. But come on, Luke, what were it like to have Roy Keane as a captain?
Yeah, Roy Keane was the ultimate captain, the ultimate leader. He drove the standards to incredible highs of in my short period at the club. I remember when I came back from Antwerp, and I was actually gutted when I got called back from Antwerp, because I assumed I was just going back to play in the reserves at United, and I was doing really well playing in the Belgian Premier League, so I was sort of gutted. But obviously I weren't going to argue with Man United, so I went back and sort of was put in the first team squad really quickly after going back. And I remember the first training session at Antwerp, I was one of the better players, doing really well, and probably wasn't pushed that hard in training because they always wanted me fit for the weekend so I could play in the game. In my first training session back at United, I probably gave the ball away a bit sloppy, and Roy Keane went absolutely mad, like calling me every name under the sun, shouting at me, and I thought, flipping heck, what have I got into here? And but then, like, after the session, he sort of said, like, come on, this is what we're at now. This is Manchester United. We've got to be on it. If we want to be successful, we need to be on it every day and do everything right every day. And he was like that with everyone, whether it was me giving the ball away or Ryan Giggs making a mistake, he'd be on them and he'd tell them, because all he cared about was that football club being successful. And for that club to be successful, everyone had to work as hard as they could every day to be right for the Saturday. And he was like, hard in terms of me and a couple of the younger lads, we used to do possession and small-sided games, and me and a couple of young lads used to say to each other when we went into small-sided games, I hope I ain't on Keane's team, because you knew if you didn't win you'd be in trouble and he'd lose his head with you. But that's how it was. But like, probably that's not sort of talked about because he's got that sort of persona as a hard man, is how he was off the pitch as well. Like he was such a supportive man, and with the young players in particular coming through, he was so good with them to give them a platform to go and play. Like there was, like I mentioned, I couldn't drive at the time, and there'd be times when he'd go out his way to pick me up from my flat to take me to train. He didn't have to do that, but because he wanted everyone to be in a good place and everyone to be settled and ready to fight for the badge and do everything they could. So he was like a scary man when he was shouting at you and having a go at you. But I think throughout my football career, there's been players that you'd probably say they're moaners, and like in different clubs that you've been at. And usually you get to a point with a player that just moans all the time where you'll just tell them to shut up, or you just won't listen to anymore. But with Roy Keane, that was never the case, because there was always a reason why he was shouting at you. There was always a reason why he was trying to make you a better player, because if you were a better player, the club was a better team and you're going to win more games. So he was the ultimate captain. The ultimate captain.
It's interesting, we'll just jump in for a second there, Stu, you know.
Yeah, of course.
Roy Keane has such a, you know, I mean, I'm not a Man United fan by a country mile, but, you know, players like Roy Keane have such a reputation for the things they do on the pitch. Now, he's fascinating to hear Luke say that, you know, that dedication to the cause was just as prevalent off the pitch, you know, around the dressing room and with the players, as it was, you know, the people watching the games on TV or as Old Trafford would have seen.
I think what... like what he does, and you see it sometimes with players, or I've seen it where it's they're doing something for the crowd, or it's for, like, not for the, everything he done weren't for himself, it was for the football club. It weren't him trying to make himself look important or a hard man or anything like that. It was all about Manchester United, and everything he done was to make it a better team and a better club.
Can I
just ask, Luke, in terms of obviously, you know, you talk about personalities there and personalities at different clubs. And I guess, you know, you sort of, your captain is almost your sort of manager's voice on the pitch. You know, I mean, Alex Ferguson, to me, seemed to control everything that went through Manchester United football from top to bottom. You know, he was that archetypal sort of, you know, he micromanaged or seemed to micromanage everything. But in terms of Roy Keane, do you think there was a... Well, there might have been a written understanding almost that sort of Ferguson gave him the latitude to do what he did and then positively encouraged it, you know, wanted more of it. Or do you think that purely by Roy Keane's nature, he would have done that anyway?
No, I think it came over a period of time, because I think when Roy Keane speaks, he talks about when he came into the dressing room, it was the likes of Brian Robson. They were that character. So I think he grew into that character and he saw over a period of time what Sir Alex Ferguson wanted in his players, what he wanted in the leaders of the team. And Keane grew into that and became one of them. And when I came into the squad at that time, is probably when he was the leader then. He was the captain of the club. And Sir Alex knew that he was the one that was running the dressing room. And that's how he wanted it. He wanted them big characters to make sure everything was in line in the dressing room, because that's going to make people, the team successful.
I mean, you know, I suppose, you know, like, again, coming to you, Stephen, you know, obviously, you know, you've asked the question about Roy Keane. You've talked about the slow, milky transition of Man United at the moment. Do you think this is, you know, this is actually what's missing, this, you know, this Roy Keane type character who is, you know, sort of the embodiment of what's needed, what's required, you know, within the club? You know, is that a major problem?
It is a major problem, but I don't think that's just Manchester United. I mean, you look at Arsenal, they've never recovered from losing your likes of Patrick Vieira. I think it's a problem across football, and I think that's partly because the players from such a young age now are so spoiled. They've got agents to look after their interests. I don't think a Roy Keane laying law down in the way that it did to young players would necessarily go down well now. There'd be players ringing their agents and ringing their mums and dads probably. Whereas I think it was just a different era, and Luke and others knew that they had to battle and listen to get into them squads. Whereas I think now players that are brought through almost have this feeling that it doesn't matter, they are going to succeed no matter what, and a lot of them fall by the wayside because of that. And you hear so many young players' names that are going to be the next big thing that never quite kick on. I think in terms of Manchester United, I can think of Ravel Morrison. It were well documented that he had them attitude problems that Alex Ferguson just couldn't abide by, even though he said he was the best young player that he'd ever seen. And even now, I look at Paul Pogba, he doesn't fulfil that potential that he's got. And I do think that's down to the fact that he's got all the money in the bank that he'll ever need. And he's got so many million social media followers. The younger isn't quite there, I don't think, to succeed in that way. I'd just like to go back to something that Luke said earlier that got me thinking, of something that I've thought about for a long time. Because I got taught, as a player that were even further away from professional football than Stu, I once got told, you know, pace was the most important thing. Pace, pace, pace. And as you said, Luke, it were a real weapon for yourself. But do you almost think it's almost the most fragile skill or quality that you can have? Because once you've got it and you rely on it so much, you look at your likes of Michael Owen and Fernando Torres, once they've had them sort of hamstring injuries where they never get that explosive pace back, they're just never quite the same again. And do you think that were a similar thing for yourself?
Yeah, I think it's about developing other things as well. Obviously, the players you mentioned there had incredible careers, but probably came because they were reliant on speed a lot of the time. They became less effective as the years went on. I think pace is a huge part of the game, but it's about having that pace. Obviously got me in the door, but I probably didn't do enough to develop other facets of my game as well to become effective. It was always maybe relying on that pace. And then when that went a little bit, it was in my career, sort of as I went down the leagues and played for different clubs, probably after leaving United, it probably took me 4 or 5 years to develop another way of playing and being effective, because it was a case of being a wide man that can then find space inside the pitch. So I think pace is obviously it is quite a fragile thing, because with anything you can lose it, but it's that time when you've got the pace is also to develop them other facets of your game to remain effective when that sort of pace disappears a little bit.
I suppose, you know, again, you know, we could talk about sort of Man United days. I'm sure all three of us could and just sit and listen, but I'm quite interested, you know, you've talked about as you sort of move down the leagues or, you know, move to different clubs, you know, I suppose two questions really. One, when you arrive at a club from Manchester United, from that incredible drive for success, you know, from being around those players, did the clubs that you went to sort of almost expect more from you or look to you to bring that almost ultra professionalism to the club, you know, and almost put that responsibility on you to bring a little bit of the Man United way, if you like, into their club? And I suppose the second part is, did it frustrate you when clubs, I mean, no club could operate like Manchester United kind of at that time, but did it frustrate you, some of the things that could have been done that weren't done?
Yeah, I think in terms of people do expect something different once they know you've been at Man United in terms of what you're going to bring to the club, which again is like maybe a little bit of pressure, but at the same time, I think the fact that if you've ever been involved at Man United or played for Man United, it does give you probably more options than if you're getting let go by a Fulham, no disrespect to them, or someone like that. It gives you more options. So people like players in particular, because you've played with top players, they want to talk about that a lot of the time. Obviously, the fans expect a little more from you maybe because you've played first team games at Manchester United. But that's just part of the game. It comes with a territory. I'm incredibly proud to say, although for a very short period of time, I played a few games for Man United, which is something I'm incredibly proud of. But at the same time, when you talk about, obviously you notice that standards are different when you go to other clubs. It's never going to be the same as Manchester United. I think I was lucky that I learned at Manchester United, so I was able to do the right things the majority of the time because I was brought up by Man United, and I owe Manchester United so much for not only the football lessons, but the life lessons of living my life that I learned there were incredible, really, and something that I've been able to take through my whole life now, even out of professional football. But when I was a kid, all I wanted to do was be a footballer. That was the goal. Like, if I played one game in the Vauxhall Conference or wherever it was then, I would have been like felt like I was absolutely buzzing. So for me, it weren't about Man United. It weren't about getting paid a load of money. It weren't about being a star. It weren't about fast cars or anything like that. All I ever wanted to do was to be a footballer. So I absolutely loved every single club that I played for. Like, don't get me wrong, there was good times and bad times at all them clubs. But it always came back to the fact that I am living my dream, as it were. I'm doing what I wanted to do from the age of 6, 7, 8 years old, from the first time my dad took me to watch a Cambridge United game at the Abbey Stadium, and I just fell in love with football. And it was never a case of, oh, I play for bloody MK Dons now and not Man United. It was never like that. It was always, I'm buzzing because I'm getting up and I'm a professional football player.
I mean, it's brilliant. Like I say, I love hearing passion and enthusiasm in anybody's voice. It doesn't matter who you know, who we're talking to. And again, Gary, you know, something else that we've sort of chatted about, sometimes players or even coaches, but certainly players just seem to either fit a club or find success at a club or find that relationship that allows them to sort of thrive and maximise either their talent, maximise their enjoyment of the game. You know, and you look at someone like Luke's career, and when you do sort of, you know, you start at Manchester United, was literally the highest you could go. You know, and you come down the leagues or you move across laterally across leagues. But at some point, you know, there's usually a club where there's like a, you know, a really good fit for a player.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this is the case, but I mean, it certainly looking at Luke's career. I was reviewing it last night, doing a bit of research for this morning. And I think he had 5 or 6 years at MK Dons, interesting when you mentioned MK Dons, which obviously suggests a successful period there. So it'd be interesting to you sort of talk about your experience at MK Dons. You know, I don't want to tear Steve away from Manchester United, but we'll just sort of wait a second, just for a second. Just interested in experiences at MK Dons, perhaps in a little bit of comparison to Manchester United, but also the success that you enjoyed there.
Yeah, I think the MK thing just fitted really well. Obviously, I left United, played for clubs, had some good performances, bad performances, but never probably settled, always suffered from a few injuries. Ended up at Norwich, which I was absolutely buzzing about because we'd started a young family and now we were all back home near where I lived, but got injured in my debut at Norwich after scoring against Ipswich in my first game, obviously the big derby, and was out for like 9 months. And I just never got myself up and running. So in terms of the move to MK Dons, I spoke to an agent and sort of handpicked them. We had a cup game at Norwich there. The stadium was incredible. It was a brand new club. It just all fitted quite nicely. Went there, done well. Like, it was a wonderful place. Arena to play football. Don't get me wrong, it weren't full up with fans, but it was an incredible stadium. It was a lovely place for me missus and me kids to come to play. I was settled at home. I was back living in the same village that I lived where I grew up. It was 40 minutes to get to the training ground, and it was just ideal for me, really. Everything just fitted into place, and like, sort of on and off the pitch, I was probably as settled as I've ever been, and I was staying fit, which obviously helps quite a lot in football when you can get yourself on the bloody pitch. So it all fitted together. The chairman was an incredible man, incredibly passionate, and always looked after us. Played with Robbie Di Matteo, Paul Ince and Carl Robinson, three managers that I had the utmost respect for and were great people as well. So it was just a really settled period in my life, really. It was just enjoying playing football.
And it just has been, just you dropped those few names there. I mean, I'm a Chelsea fan. So Robbie Di Matteo, absolute hero to me, obviously won us the European Cup. Just be interested in just what are your impressions of him? I mean, when he went from MK to West Brom, and they played some amazingly nice football. I remember watching a game on the television, and they were playing, I think, away at Bolton. I think they had two players sent off and probably 9 men, which still were the best team on the park. Played some really lovely football. So what was this football like under Robbie Di Matteo?
Yeah, Robbie was a really good coach in terms of his tactical work. Like, he didn't do a huge... Like, he worked with... Eddie Newton was there with us, and Eddie used to do the majority of the work on the training field. But Robbie was a real studious tactician in terms of how we played in possession, out possession. And being a League One club at the time, we played a completely different style in terms of where we pressed. We'd drop off really deep, which probably weren't the norm in League One, where you'd just go and press everyone, was sort of the normal way to play. So it was a real studious way of playing. He was like quite quiet, didn't really interact like with a lot of the foreign managers. It was more of, this was his job. He weren't there to be mates with everyone. But I really enjoyed working with Robbie, and he was a good man and a real studious tactical coach.
Yeah, it's interesting about Eddie Newton, because obviously Eddie Newton came to Chelsea with him as well. And I think Eddie's just won a title in Turkey as a coach in Turkey. So, you know, there you go. He's sort of moved on from there. Yeah, fascinating. Fascinating, mate. Thank you. I'm going back to Chelsea for a minute.
Yeah, I thought you would at some point. I'm pretty sure we'll get on to Dutch football just before we finish. Stephen, you know, I suppose, you know, if you're looking at footballers' careers, and you know, the dream start is the big club, the European Championships, perennial league winners, and then the end of the career is sort of that hometown, play for your hometown club, play in front of your family, play, you know, almost sort of live the dream. that you probably have, you know, that players probably have as a young boy. You know, and again, it's something that Luke sort of managed within this, you know, what is an incredibly good and successful professional career.
Yeah, I mean, obviously us as sports and football writers, it's almost that perfect ending to the story, isn't it? Luke's spoken with us today about his bit of an hometown boy. He didn't want to leave his mum and dad. And what a way to return. What would it have been? Best part of 15 to 20 years later, return back to Cambridge United and help them out. Bit of a returning hero, I guess. And you're still there now, Luke. So have you still got that same love for Cambridge United that you always had?
Yeah, I think I always will do. They're the I owe Cambridge United my football career, really, because if I didn't go to them games when I was a kid, I probably wouldn't have fell in love with a game to the depth that I did, and I probably wouldn't have made it my priority to become a professional footballer and end up playing at that stadium. I mean, it's when people ask me, I know it's a strange answer to, like, that was the proudest moment without a shadow of doubt in my football career, was going to sign for Cambridge United and playing for the team that I loved and supported when I grew up. I mean, don't get me wrong, I know that's a little bit weird, a little bit strange. I think if you spoke to the majority of my teammates, they'd all quite like me, but they'd say I was a bit of a strange guy in some ways. And I think this is strange, but that was always the dream. That was always the fantasy when I went to bed at night, was thinking about scoring at the Newmarket Road end at the Abbey Stadium. So to actually have done that, I'm so, like, feel so humble and proud that I've, like, there's not many people that can say that they lived their dream and they done the thing that they always wanted to do as a kid. So to have done that is something that I feel so lucky to be able to say that I've done. And it's something that I'm so, so proud of. And that goal, obviously, to play for them was incredible. But scoring that goal, in that goal where I used to stand behind as a kid, was a special moment in my career.
It's, I mean, like I say, you know, we could chat about your football career all day. I appreciate you're probably far busier than I am at the moment. But in terms of, you know, with regards to lockdown, you know, and there's a lot of stuff in the press at the moment, you know, and rightly so, about mental health and those sorts of things as well. And I know, you know, like Gary said, you know, we've been looking at, once we knew we were lucky enough to get this interview, and, you know, and going back through stuff. And there's, you know, there's sort of a couple of periods in your career where you talk about mental health and, you know, like I said, a bit of the intro, you know, probably one of the few players who has been brave enough to sort of come out and not, and it's more about how it made you feel. And, you know, football is what certainly was traditionally, and probably still is, an incredibly macho, show no weakness sort of environment and world. And yet, you know, to me, it seems really important that actually that's the environment. They're the people who actually can reach, and we've seen it with Marcus Rashford on other topics, but, you know, professional footballers, football clubs, they have such a huge reach with regards to the general public. And, you know, you're one of the, like I say, one of the few who've been brave enough to talk about not only sort of the troubles through social media as a player, but also once your career finished and that sense of not loss, but almost, what do I do? What do I do with my time? What, you know, what's my purpose now? And again, you know, Was it a big decision, I suppose, to come out and speak about these things?
No, it weren't a big decision. Obviously, I'm new to, quite new to social media. I never use it throughout my life, and started using it probably about just over a year ago. And usually the sort of content that I put out on Twitter is just awful, awful banter that's got no sort of value to it whatsoever. So it was a case of putting a tweet out in a really hard time for everyone in the first lockdown, where everyone's mental health would have been fluctuating because we're in such a strange situation. It was a case of saying, like, when I went through the struggles at Man United, when I was on the telly and people were talking about the way I looked, etc., and it made me feel really, really down in myself, but I couldn't talk about it. I didn't know how to approach it, and I just suffered in silence, as it were. So the tweet that I put out was a positive message in terms of, if you are struggling, talk about it. Don't do what I done back then. And don't get me wrong, I know I'm not a big superstar, and Luke Chadwick says that, I'm going to go and talk about my problems. But if it could have helped one person, which I got messages saying that it helped them talk about, and then it did. I think the whole message got lost a little bit, in terms of, then it was just a case of the TV show that that took the piss out of me or whatever, which it was never about that. That, like, that's gone now. It was a case of, if you're struggling, try and talk about it, because it's the best thing you can do to take that weight off your shoulders. So I was absolutely amazed, in, to be honest with you, in terms of how much attention that it got. I wasn't expecting anything like that. So it was, again, it was a strange situation, but it was just trying to offer a positive message in a, like, a real hard time, which incredibly we're still bloody in now in another lockdown, but hopefully not too much longer till we get back to some normality.
It, I mean, it's like, you know, I said there at the beginning, Gary, and, you know, certainly yourself, you know, we look at sort of football and how it fits in political frameworks, and like we say, Marcus Rashford and what he's doing at the moment. But, you know, like we've just said there, you know, and Luke's very self-effacing there, where, you know, he might not claim to be this megastar and this superstar, but he's still lived the life that millions, not just kids in England or Britain, but, you know, millions of kids around the world want to live. And whether, not say whether Luke likes it or not, but whether he comes to terms with it or not, people will listen to what guys like Luke have to say. You know, they are massive, massive messages.
Yeah, a celebrity inevitably, you know, whether they want it or not, does give people a platform. That puts them on a platform, and, you know, it's how people use it. And guys like Luke, you know, who come out and offer positive message and encouraging for people. And, you know, as he says, even if it helps one person, that's great. Absolute terrific, man. You know, if you can, you know, you always give people a hand up. You never give them a knock down if you can. And, you know, more credit to you, buddy, for doing that.
Yeah, if it's any consolation to you, Luke, I've used you as a case study for my my football degree coaching programme that I'm doing, because we're doing sort of health and lifestyle and sort of the impact of mental health on, you know, on young players, you know, on players. And I've given them you as the case study, knowing that we're going to chat to you today, but I've given them you as a case study. So,
well, I hope you pass, then. You don't fail.
No, don't worry, they'll pass. But again, it's trying to get across to the younger generation, you know, who have grown up with social media, who have grown up with this instant sort of method of communication, or the ability to hide behind communication, hide behind comments, without actually really knowing the impact and effect it has. And like you say, if you have no outlet, or if people feel like they have no outlet for it, people like you, and we sort of interviewed Neville Southall a little while ago as well, who's quite passionate on Twitter about the LGBT, you know, and he, to be fair, he was a lot like you, were very self-effacing, very, you know, if I help one person, it is massive what you do. The reach, the impact that you can have is huge. Is it something that, I'm not saying you would like to take further, but is it something that you're happy to continue to engage with?
Yeah, I'm like more than happy to engage about it. If, like I say, if probably the best feeling I've ever had is the messages I received off the back of that, of people saying what you've said's helped me, and like off the back of one little tweet and then talking about it a little bit, which is like makes me feel so humble, so incredibly proud that me saying that has helped someone, because there's no better feeling in the world than helping someone. So in terms of that respect, like, it's absolutely fantastic. It's not something where I'm thinking, like, I can take this. If anyone ever wants to speak to me then about this subject, I'm more than happy to speak about it. And if there's anything I could ever do to try and help, then that's what I'll try and do. But in terms of, I don't know, having a career or something like that, it's not something I've ever thought about in any way, really.
Well, no, I don't want to put pressure on you to all of a sudden I didn't mean to do that. Don't worry. Nobody listens to this anyway. Don't worry. You'll be fine. I appreciate time is precious. I suppose what, you know, we started with you, Stephen. You know, this was, you know, your interview you arranged. You're the Manchester United fan. You know, I know what it's like speaking with heroes. And so I suppose it's only right and proper that, you know, we sort of give you the last question for Luke before we let him go. I want to say, I'm going to say on Luke's behalf, I apologise. Ask him anything you want. It's the last question. Anything you want to know before you get these opportunities very often. So, you know, is there any last thing that you want to know?
Hey, well, I'd just like to pick up on the mental health thing again as well and just say well done again. I think the key thing is, for anybody that is suffering, I've had some struggles in the past myself. It can be a very lonely place, and knowing that other people are going through it is almost a therapeutic in itself. And I think especially knowing that somebody in the public eye, somebody who's had success, somebody who's already had the dreams that you might have had, knowing that it can also happen to them and that it can happen to anybody, makes you feel like, you know, it's not you that's just being a failure, or it's not you that's just whatever you might be down on yourself about. So I think that's great. What one thing I did want to know is, I mean, that 99-2000 season when you came back from Antwerp, won the Premier League at an absolute canter that season. That was your sort of strongest contribution for United. Were it enough to win a medal? And who were your sort of closest allies in that team? Who were your closest friends?
Like the young lads used to stick together. So I was always knocking about with John O'Shea, Wes Brown, Roy Carroll at the time, just the young lads there. I managed to get a medal, yeah. I always bring that up to anyone that asks that I was lucky enough to win a medal. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm pretty sure if I weren't there that season, they still would have won the league without me. But it's still obviously incredible to be in and around the squad that year. And it is, I think, something maybe as a young, like I spoke about my time at Cambridge with great pride. I've got great pride of playing for Man United, but you maybe appreciate things a little bit more as you get older. So it probably, now I look back now, it seems probably a more amazing thing to have won that league medal than maybe it did back then at the time when it happened. But again, it was it's great to stick that on every Saturday night when I go clubbing around Cambridge and everyone can see what I want.
Luke, I've gone a minute over your time. I am really sorry. I'm trying. There is so much that I'm sure that we could all still ask you. Gary, enjoyed your morning.
Brilliant. You know, when you talk to people, you never know what they're going to be like. And Luke, thoroughly decent guy. So, you know, thank you, mate, for coming on and having a chat with us. And in about 5 minutes' time, we'll have one extra follower on Twitter. look out for me. My name's my tag's All Blue Day, so I'll give you a wave. And thanks, mate. That's been brilliant. Brilliant hour.
No worries. My pleasure, guys. It's been a pleasure meeting you. I'm going to have to shoot off and jump on this other call, but have a great day.
Thanks, no Luke. Thank you.
Thank you ever so much, Luke. Cheers, thanks Luke. A lot. Take care. Wow. We'll still record, guys. Enjoyed that.
That was brilliant. That was brilliant. Great work, Stephen. Getting him on, mate. Brilliant.
Yeah, no.
Cracking guy.
Yeah, no. I felt a bit of a almost a slight weight of responsibility, and hoping that it went well. I think that went better than I could have thought. Really, is a really decent, great guy, isn't he?
Terrific.
You know when it's going well when you look at the time and you're about 40 minutes in, and it's the first time you've looked at it, and you're like, oh my god, we've only got. It's when you look at it and it's about, you've only gone 10 minutes in and you're like, oh no, this is going to be, going to take some dragging out. But yeah, it was absolutely sensational. Great work, Stephen.
Yeah. No, thanks. Well done for hosting, Stu. It was it flowed really well. Really happy with that.
Okay. Obviously, you've caught a little bit of the chat that we do after a podcast. Obviously, thanks on to Luke, who's now popped off for another chat. Gary, thank you ever so much for joining us.
Absolute joy. Because I normally say after we do the pods that, you know, we spend an hour in the evening in the glass of beer talking to my friends about football, but today we spent an hour with a cup of coffee, well, a cup of tea actually it was, and talking this morning about football, but terrific, really enjoyed it. What a decent guy.
And Stephen, like Gary said, what a brilliant recruitment to the podcast. It was sensational. Great work by you.
Thank you. Yeah, cheers, enjoyed it.
All right. Obviously, all that's left for me to say is I can't promise the next episode. We'll have another ex-pro at Manchester United with chats about Alex Ferguson and Roy Keane. However, don't let that put you off. And please join us again next time on the Lob podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.